Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from my house. On behalf of Goffman Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies, I welcome you to an extraordinary experience, the reading of the book, The Return to Zion, and Addresses on Religious Zionism and American Orthodoxy by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, one of the great Talmudists and thinkers and philosophers of American Jewry and indeed world Jewry of the 20th century. He was, of course, a member of the great Soloveitchik legacy and family. His father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchok Yochanan until his passing, at which point Rabbi Yosher Ber Soloveitchik took over. He was the grandson of Chaim Brisker, Chaim Soloveitchik, who revolutionized Talmud study, and he was the great-grandson of the Beis HaLevi, for whom he is named, Rabbi Yosher Ber Soloveitchik. Many of you listened in to our reading of the Rav, The Life and Teachings of Rabbi Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, Volume 1, by Dr. Aaron Rothkopf, Rakefet. Hope you enjoyed that. This book is going to be a virtuoso performance by Rabbi Yosher Ber Soloveitchik. These are addresses that he delivered to the Mizrahi annual convention, Mizrahi movement, in various hotels, various years. And we're going to place each one in its context, time-wise, and hopefully that'll add a little bit of understanding to us. These were lectures and speeches given in Yiddish. They were originally published in a work a few years back by the OU Press, and this time translation has been made into English, and we're all very grateful for that. So without further ado, I'm going to read you address number one, and in the translator's introduction, let me just give you his name. It's a very extensive introduction by the translator. And we'll try to touch on each and every piece that he discusses. Before every single lecture that Rabbi Soloveitchik gave in Yiddish, he has a whole, background story as to where that was published and the manuscript and some of the footnotes and how he dealt with the translation of it and so on. This is Rabbi Shaul Seidler Feller of New York City, who translated this not long ago. He signed this on December 26th of last year, Zos Chanukah. That's literally 5 months ago, 6 months ago. That's not long ago. Only half a year ago did he finish this, and it was recently put into production, and we have it here in front of us now. And I'm very grateful to the OU for publishing it. So that without further ado, let's get right to it. The very first lecture that he's going to give us is called We Take Refuge Exclusively Under the Shadow of He Who Spoke and the World Came into Being, delivered in May of 1939. So it's both having to do with the white paper by the British, a little bit more about that in a moment, and also it is at around the time that World War II is going to break out with Germany invading Poland in the year of 1939. So it was a really super important year. Let me read you a few seconds of the translator's introduction to this very address, and then we'll get to it. Rabbi Shaul Seidler Feller writes, as can be seen in the facsimile reproduced on page 24 of the Drushes, and that was a book, as I said earlier, that was the Yiddish book put out by the OU, and it's called the Drushes Vegan Shivas Tzion, lectures regarding the return to Zion. Remember, he spoke all these lectures in Yiddish, and the Rav eventually became super fluent in English, and so he then began writing in English. Very unusual ability to come to English at a slightly later age and master it so profoundly. At all events, though, these speeches were given in Yiddish. And so he says over here, the manuscript of chapter 1, which is, of course, the one that I'm going to read to you, it bears the date Friday, 23rd of Iyar, 5699, and that corresponds to May 12th of 1939. And it was written in a hand other than the Rav's. This address was delivered at the annual Mizrahi Convention held at the Breakers Hotel in Atlantic City, New Jersey. According to a contemporary report, Rabbi Soloveitchik spoke at the convention's second session and gave, quote, a philosophical talk of beautiful form and profound content. That is the impression given by a Miriam Goranchik. And Miriam Goranchik was the younger sister of Rabbi Shlomo Goranchik. Some of you may know him as Rabbi Shlomo Goren, Rabbi of Israel during the Six-Day War. It appears from that newspaper article, writes Rabbi Shaul Seidler-Feller, as well as Chapter 2 of the present volume, in which the Rav references something he said at the 1939 convention, that the address has not been preserved in its entirety in manuscript. It's also far shorter than are the other chapters. You'll see that in a moment. What I'm going to read to you, the opening chapter one, if you will, we take refuge, it's very short. The second piece I'm going to begin reading to you is exceptionally long. I don't know if we can get through all of it today. I doubt that we can. It's a very, very long piece. It's a beautiful piece. It's a sad piece. Worth your while. Every single thing that he wrote and said was worth our while. Let's continue with this for just a moment, laying a foundation, and then we'll get to it. The timing of this drusha, of drusha number one, we'll call it. We take refuge exclusively. The timing of this drusha of 1939 is important, as it came on the eve of the publication and ratification by the House of Commons of Colonial Secretary Malcolm McDonald's white paper, in which declaration the British government declared, quote, that it is not part of their policy that Palestine should become a Jewish state, end quote. And it severely limited Jewish immigration to the land of Israel, among other measures. Remember, Rabbi Soloveitchik lived through basically the entire 20th century. He was born in 1903. I left this out. Shouldn't have. He was born in 1903, passed away in 1993, lived a full 90 years. It's an incredible amount of years anyway, and it spans virtually the entire century. He took a vast interest in contemporary and current events, and as a member and a leader of the Mizrahi, he was keenly interested in what the British had to say about anything regarding Palestine, because the British had been given the mandate from, my understanding is, my recollection, from the League of Nations in 1918, upon the ending of World War I, to hold on to Palestine and try to figure out what to do with Palestine regarding the Jews who were interested in getting a homeland and the local Arabs who wanted nothing at all of that. You'll recall that the Balfour Declaration, which was promulgated in or around 1917 or 1918, maybe even 1922 for all I remember, was perfectly positive towards giving the Jewish people a homeland. And then suddenly the white paper comes along and negates all that. So the feelings of the feelings of depression among Zionist Jews in 1939 had to be very, very acute, because one minute they're working off of a British Balfour Declaration, which is very positive towards a potential Jewish homeland in Palestine. And then in 1939, along comes the white paper and says, quote, we've got no interest. It's not part of their policy that Palestine should become a Jewish state. That's crushing. And it wound up severely limiting Jewish immigration to the land of Israel, among other measures. Hence, you had people fighting the British. Friends, if you're trying to speak, I welcome any participation, but it's got to be in English, and so this way I can respond to it. And also, may I ask respectfully, everybody, by all means, jump in and ask any questions you want. I'll try to answer them. But also, if you're not ready to ask a question, please mute yourself until you are indeed ready to ask a question or make a comment. Everything's welcome. It's very interesting. We're trying to make this as interactive as possible, but I'm going to ask everybody to please mute himself or herself until such time as you're ready to make a contribution to this conversation. So Rabbi Soloveitchik is speaking in or around May of 1939. The beginning of World War II is going to break out, if it hasn't already, with Germany invading Poland, and it's in the wake of the White Paper, which is very devastating to those Jews who were of a Zionist bent, who wanted to see a state of Israel. And now, without further ado, in this new book, recently published, just recently, a very, very hot off the press, The Return to Zion. I'm on page one. We take refuge exclusively under the shadow of He who spoke, and the world came into being. May 1939. Quoting Amos, the prophet, in chapter 7, verse 14 of the biblical book of Amos, I am not a prophet, and I am not a prophet's son. I am neither a politician nor the son of a politician. As a rule, my family is very poorly endowed with statesmen and diplomats. It is primarily comprised of idlers, as you would say, batlanim, denizens of the Beit Midrash, meaning those who hang out in the study hall, yeshiva deans, and rabbis who have never had any exchanges with European diplomats or any dealings with governments. Therefore, I do not wish today to deliver political addresses or get into arguments with the English government, demonstrating to Malcolm MacDonald with clear proofs that he was deceived by lies or that the English government didn't keep its word. God save us. That's also why I was never among, quote, those who descended to Egypt. It could be that in moments of joy and ecstasy, I was not the truly happiest among the revelers, because empty promises and contentless declarations have never animated me. But by the same token, I am not now grieving among the mourners. I have not fallen into a sense of despair or panic, and I do not attempt to pick at eternal wounds, remonstrating that all my friends have played me false. There's an allusion to Lamentations chapter 1. For the more justified we are, the more intense are the gloom and the hopelessness. So he's in the middle of everything. He was never a big believer. He was never among those who descended to Egypt. The joy and the ecstasy that others felt, he didn't get into it. If the British gave a baffled declaration, it was just a piece of paper, and it expressed a hope or an interest or an aspiration, but he didn't put too much faith in it. He's not a statesman. His family doesn't come from statesmen. He's not here to deliver a political address, he says. I'm not here to argue with the British. I'm not here to demonstrate to the British that they've been deceived by lies. I'm not here to tell the British that they didn't keep their word, heaven forbid. I'm not here to do that. And the more justified we are in our hope as Jews that we should have in Israel, the more gloom and doom we wind up having. With a get us. He continues, unfortunately, I have felt neither the joyous moments nor the tragic moments of, quote, those who descended to Egypt. My psychology is that of an idler, I-D-L-E-R in English, somebody who idles around. Don't idle your car, meaning don't sit in it and run the engine and get nowhere. A batlan is somebody who's hanging around, not going anywhere fast. Now, he's kibitzing, of course, when he calls himself a batlan. Talmud says he's supposed to have 10 batlanim in a town studying the Torah. If a person studying the Torah is anything but a batlan, he's not wasting time, because the verb levatel means to, like, to deny or to levatel. He's mevatel, you know, he annuls a decree. You know, somebody's not doing a whole lot. So I am sure he's kibitzing around, because after all, to call himself an idler, or his father, or his grandfather, or his great-grandfather, these are some of the greatest rabbinic minds of the past 150, 200 years. Far from us to call any one of them a batlan. And yet, since that's the Talmud's language, he's adopting it. He says, my idler's psychology, page 2, has shielded me against wild spiritual plunges from a high roof to a low pit. And I now also recall the words of a member of our spiritual family, one of the 10 idlers, whose name is Rabbi Avun. See Rut Rabbah, the Midrashic compilation on Rus, chapter 5, subsection 4. See also Yalkut Shimoni on Rus, section 602. Rabbi Avun was not a statesman, and he did not stand at the helm of Jewish politics. He did not negotiate with ministers and kings. He was a naive, typically Jewish Torah scholar. Nothing naive about a Torah scholar. It's just that, I guess, the point that he's trying to make in a somewhat sarcastic way is such a person may not have a certain polish, maybe, is what he means, that you get from meeting with diplomats constantly. There's a certain way you speak and a certain way you address and a certain way that's accepted among the nations of the world, diplomatically speaking. And it could be that somebody whose whole life is spent in a Beit Midrash is a little bit rougher and tougher around the edges and doesn't have that certain kind of a polish. He's just rough. And in the Mochamta Shel Torah and the war that is Torah study, you let it all out on your friend and you engage in discussion and then debate and then argumentation, and you're trying to figure out what's right. And it's nothing personal. It's just you're trying to fight to figure out what is being said and what's the proper interpretation of it. But that might lead to somebody not having a certain kind of a polish, perhaps. And so maybe that's why he's using this term, that Rabbi Oven was a naive, typically Jewish Torah scholar. Perhaps that's what he means. Here's the quote. It's about wings. Rabbi Oven said, "We have heard," says Rabbi Soloveitchik, he does not tell us from whom, but presumably great Jewish leaders said it. Historians, thinkers, philosophers, social reformers, those who have shaped and molded Jewish history, those who have avoided reckoning with people like Rabbi Oven and their opinions, those who have looked down upon Rabbi Oven and his colleagues as upon a group of old-fashioned idlers who have no understanding of modern life and its problems. Rabbi Oven continues, "We have heard that the sun has wings, as it says in the prophet Malachi, Malachi chapter 3, but for you who revere my name, a sun, S-U-N, as in the orb in the sky, a sun of justice shall rise to bring healing in its wings." End quote of the verse of Malachi. Rabbi Soloveitchik, those who proclaimed the sun has wings, Mendelssohn, David Friedlander, Marcus Hertz, Daniel Itzig, were not nobodies. They were people who determined the direction of Jewish history for 150 years. Quote, "The great culture sun has wings, and under the pinions of modern civilization can all the weak and persecuted seek refuge. The radiant culture sun furnishes justice and healing to all those who wish to enter its orbit and benefit from its warmth and light." Now, of course, he's quoting from, I don't really know who. It could be Mendelssohn, it could be Friedlander, Marcus Hertz, Itzig. I've never heard of Marcus Hertz or Itzig, to be totally frank with you. And Friedlander, I think I have heard of. I think he was a reformist. Of course, Moses Mendelssohn goes without saying. Some say he was the father of the Haskalah, the Enlightenment. And so he's quoting enlightened Jews, Jews of the Haskalah, the Maskilim, who say, "The sun itself has wings. The great culture sun, the sun of Tarbut, of culture, of music and art, literature and poetry, of cafes in Paris and art studios in Berlin, and things like that. That'll be our hope, that the great culture sun has wings, and under the pinions of modern civilization can all the weak and persecuted seek refuge. The radiant culture sun furnishes justice and healing to all those who wish to enter its orbit and benefit from its warmth and light." The thinking of the Maskilim, of the enlightened Jews. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, "It is not a Jewish problem," said they. "The persecution of the Jews is connected with, on the one hand, the ignorance of the Gentiles, and on the other, the ignorance of the ghetto-type Jew." Here he quotes again from somebody, from some one of those four. Quote, "Come, Jews, under the wings of the culture sun. It will bring you liberté, égalité, fraternité. It'll bring you liberty, egalitarianism,
fraternity, the slogan of the French Revolution. That's me. End quote of that Come Jews quote. Here's where it's elevation. Jews heard the message loud and clear. They streamed in from all directions. They destroyed bridges that connect us with the ancient past. They forgot themselves in order to seek shelter under the wings of the sun, protection, justice, and healing. Rabbi Avraham and those like him fought not, heaven forbid, against the culture sun itself, but against the wild faith Jews placed in its wings and against the sacrifices Jews offered on its altar. They fought, but lost. The tide of history was against them. And today, 150 years later, at a time when it seems as though the entire Jewish people is under the culture sun, where are the justice and the healing? Who will remove the dirt from your eyes, O German sages? See Mishnah Sota, chapter 2, Mishnah 2, page 3. People speak of the bankruptcy of modern culture. We like to generalize our individual experiences, but this is wrong. The sun indeed has wings, just not for Jews. Rabbi Alvin continues, we have heard that the earth has wings, as it says in Isaiah 24, from the end of the earth we hear singing. But he translates from the end, meaning from the wing of the earth we hear singing. Right, Rabbi Soloveitchik, the earth, the soil, the state has wings. All citizens can take shelter beneath these pinions. One need only seek to enter underneath them, leave the ghetto, cease to function as a corpus in corpore, a foreign body, and become a free citizen with equal rights, active in all areas of civic life. Again, Jews followed. Again, they had faith. They threw themselves with all their zeal into civic life, participated in all areas of national concern, sacrificed, and fought on the battlefield, hoping that those wings would ultimately bring singing to Jewish citizens. But the historical end result of those hopes in Central Europe shows that sometimes from the wings of the state, we hear lamenting. It is true that the state has great, powerful wings. The national flag is strong enough to protect its citizens the world over. We witnessed that this past year. But Jews have found no refuge under the flag. The wings of both the sun and the earth have betrayed us. We have heard, continues Rabbi Avraham, that the cherubim have wings, as it says in 1 Kings chapter 8, for the cherubim had their wings spread out, end quote, says Rabbi Soloveitchik. Other leaders have told us that there are cherubim among the Gentile rulers who grasp the tragedy of the Jewish people, cherubim whose hearts are full of uprightness and fairness, cherubim who are ready to make amends for the great historical injustice perpetrated by the Christian world against the Jews. These cherubim have indeed used very elegant language and magnificent rhetoric, and they drew up a historic declaration. Here he means the Balfour Declaration, acknowledging the most basic right of our nation, which of course was to go back to Israel. The last 20 years have passed under the ensign of Jews' trust in these holy cherubim and their declarations. And now it appears that the wings of the cherubim too have duped us. The last faith of the Jews too has collapsed. But the righteous, Avers Rabbi Avraham the Idler, foresaw this 150 years ago, when Rabbi Raphael Hamburger and a generation later, Rabbi Akiva Eger struggled against the cult of the Son of Justice bringing healing in its wings. Those are the Maskilim. When Shaddal, Shmuel David Lutzato, warned Isaac Marcus, Yost, against excessive optimism about and unshakable faith in the wings of the earth. When the rabbis of Russia put the youth on guard about too fully trusting in the cherubim of socialism, as well as when we, the idlers, yelled at the Zionist Organization of America that no great movement to return to Zion can be built upon paper promises and diplomatic courtesies. Can't build a movement like that based upon a British piece of paper, says Rabbi Soloveitchik. It won't work. You won't be able to get anybody to go. Now, of course, in 1939, people had already been going to the land of Israel for upwards of 50 years. In the 1880s, people who were not so much into the religion anymore, but who were inspired by an early Zionism, were finding their way, leaving Europe and finding their way to Israel, to the land then called Palestine. And there, they began to plant, drain swamps, buy land, build kibbutzim, moshavim, maybe a hospital here and there, maybe a school here and there. And they did indeed begin to plant the seeds of contemporary State of Israel. Rabbi Soloveitchik does not seem to be mentioning that. Instead, he's saying that no great movement to return to Zion can be built upon paper promises and diplomatic courtesies. Well, he's right about that, no doubt. And people who were delighted with the Balfour Declaration were easily crushed by the white paper. But remember, there were already thousands of Jews who already made their way to Israel. And I'm curious as to why he didn't acknowledge that. But in all events, we continue. And this ends the first address by Rabbi Soloveitchik in this book, this last paragraph. Who do you think we're going to be able to take refuge in? Under whose wings can we, as Jews, take refuge? Will it be the nations of the world? Will it be the culture of the day? Will it be socialism? What will it be? Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, a verse in Psalms, Psalm 36, verse 8. The righteous, he says, quote, take refuge exclusively under the shadow of he who spoke, and the world came into being. As it says, how precious is your faithful care, O God. Mankind shelters in the shadow of your wings. Those wings have never fooled us, never betrayed us, and yet we have, on more than one occasion, ripped and torn those wings because of the treacherous pinions of the sun, earth, and cherubim. Wow. Beautiful. Fabulous. Finding that midrash in Rus Rabba, Yalkut Shimoni, of Rabbi Avon, talking about the wings. We have heard that there are wings, that the sun has wings, that the earth has wings, that the cherubim have wings. And he relates it so beautifully to the contemporary age and ends off as a good rabbi should, reminding us that we as Jews take refuge exclusively under the shadow of he who spoke and the world came into being. Still have time. I'm now going to begin address number 2. It's a long one. It starts on page 5, ends on page 28. Very, very moving, very touching. We'll try to do this in 2 steps. We'll try our best. We'll do what we can. We'll begin today, and with God's help, we'll try to conclude it next week. But you got to begin something if you want to start and end something. Now, chapter 2, writes Rabbi Shaul Seidler Fellow, the translator, has survived in 2 manuscript versions, one longer than the other, with the shorter one presumably constituting the version that the Rav ultimately delivered. Professor Fishman, who he refers to as his mentor and great Yiddish teacher, had questions he would ask Professor Fishman. Professor Fishman printed this shorter text as the main body of the drusha, but quoted variants from the longer manuscript in the footnotes. In my translation, I've incorporated these variants without marking them as such. Let's skip a little bit. From contemporary newspaper accounts, we learn that this talk was given at the National Conference of Orthodox Jewry for Palestine and Rescue, convened by a number of North American Orthodox organizations, including the Mizrahi and the Hapoel HaMizrahi, at the Hotel Pennsylvania in New York City on Sunday and Monday, January 30 and 31 of the year 1944, with Rabbi Soloveitchik serving as one of the event's four honorary presidents. By way of background, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had recently, only a week before, established the World Refugee Board to aid in the rescue of Jewish victims of the Holocaust, and, quote, a resolution urging the U.S. to take appropriate measures leading to the establishment of a Jewish Commonwealth in Palestine was introduced in the House of Representatives on January 27. The Rebbe was slated to deliver an address entitled The Destruction of the Jewish People and of Judaism during the conference's opening session on Sunday afternoon. The translation of a line from Bialik's Meitei Midbar HaAchronim that appears herein is the work of C. David Matt. I just recently came across something on the web that FDR was interested in relocating Jews, not to the United States, but to Africa, because he did not want lots of Jews in the United States. He was happy to see them in Africa somewhere. Meanwhile, the House of Representatives is talking about leading an establishment of a Jewish Commonwealth in Palestine. So at least that's along the right path. But FDR, who I'm no fan of, was interested, according to what I saw, what I read, he was apparently interested in developing some kind of Jewish homeland somewhere in Africa. I don't know where. Not necessarily Uganda. I don't remember exactly where the article or the short was referencing it. Somewhere in Africa. In all events, we begin right now. Page 5. The parchment is consumed, but the letters fly free. Of course, that is a reference to Rabbi Akiva or another one of the great sages. I think Rabbi Yosef Ben Tarajon, who was being burnt at the stake, and parchments of Torah scrolls were being added to the fire. His student said, Rabbi, what do you see? He says, I see the parchment consumed, but the letters are flying free, going up to heaven. An incredible vision. Incredible. People are just incredible. Absolutely incredible. Mordechai ben Rabotai, delivered in January 1944. Imagine what was going on. There were people new in January of 1944. I begin, here's Rabbi Soloveitchik. Morai v'rabotai, assembled gentlemen, I was asked to speak about the destruction of the Jewish people and of Judaism, a topic that requires a Jeremiah and a Baruch ben Neriah, each writing an entire book of Lamentations composed of multiple alphabetic acrostics to do it justice. I cannot take up this topic. We are now living through a destruction that is unquestionably more extensive than those of the first and second temples, both in quantity and in quality. The admonition in Deuteronomy 28, together with all the other plagues and curses not mentioned therein, see Deuteronomy 28, verse 61, have been realized in their full gruesomeness and horror. We have lost the oldest and greatest Jewish centers. We have lost millions of Jews. We have lost the best and the finest that the Jewish people has to offer. Everyone knows this. There is no need to expound upon it. Reality itself supplies the most terrifying picture of the situation. Every newspaper and every report unfolds into a scroll of blood and fire. There is an age-old halakha found in Tractate Shabbos, page 32a, and in Evel Zutarti, chapter 1, subsection 2. Quote, as a person was approaching death, they would say to him, confess before you die. Many who confessed did not pass away, while many others passed away without confessing. End quote. When an individual or a community finds himself or itself in a time of distress, in a moment of crisis, when the fate of the person or group in question will be decided, he or it must confess. The Torah concludes the admonition in Leviticus with mention of the ancient Jewish laws of introspection and confession. Quote,
You shall perish among the nations, and the land of your enemies shall consume you. Those of you who survive shall be heartsick over their iniquity in the land of your enemies. And they shall confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers, in that they trespassed against me. Yea, they were hostile to me. Leviticus 26, a national admonition, a gruesome catastrophe, must close with confession. Page 6. But I must make this distinguished gathering aware that even if the general conception of confession is connected with transgression, with a guilty conscience, with a sin of sinfulness and wrongdoing, the idea of confession is actually much deeper and more expansive. It plays a colossal role in modern philosophy, especially in the neo-Kantian school founded by Hermann Cohen. Hermann Cohen, the Jew, who, like other Jews of his time, unfortunately did not appreciate the ideal of loving and returning to Zion. Universal thought functions according to the laws of confession. Reality is constituted through self-reflection, retrospective examination, and consideration of the past are lofty gifts granted the human mind by the creator of the world, two of the principal distinctive features in which, quote, the superiority of man over the beast, see Ecclesiastes 3, is manifest. If that is true of human consciousness in general, it is especially characteristic and typical of us Jews, who have never considered the present moment to be the final goal, the objective of objectives. We Jews, who have lived for thousands of years with the chronological distinction between Bazman Hazeh, nowadays, and La'atid Lavo, the messianic future, and who gave the world the concept of the end of days, also bequeathed it the Song of Moses. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of ages past. Deuteronomy 32. For one cannot contemplate the future from the perspective of the present. One must do so from the point of view of the past. Gemara in Brachos, Mishnah Brachos chapter 9, Mishnah 5. All blessings recited in the temple would conclude min ha'olam, v'ad ha'olam, from eternity to eternity. When Jews standing in the temple would say, blessed are you, God our God, King of ha'olam, the world, they would immediately explain what they meant by ha'olam. Not a small world of the present, of this moment, of diminutive, egotistical aspirations of death and extirpation, but a great, unending future world leading to the vision of the end of days, eternity. They would therefore conclude, min ha'olam v'ad ha'olam, from the eternal past into the eternal future. That is the olam, the world of those reciting blessings in the temple. And that is the olam over which the God of Israel reigns. This concluding phrase, min ha'olam v'ad ha'olam, from world to world, would be added in order to counter the claim of the Sadducees that believed, or who believed, quote, only this world exists, a world of the present, of the moment, of the passing, disappearing, instant. No eternal Israel can be built in the future without introspection, immersing oneself deeply in the eternal Israel of the past. Page 7. Confession involves retrospection toward the past, perspective on the present, and vision for the future. Especially during such a time of distress, an hour of divine wrath and anger, when providence is, as if one could say this, a lurking bear to me, a lion in hiding,
See Lamentations 3. We must certainly fulfill the aforementioned halakha. They would say to him, confess. Confessing does not mean wailing or rending one's garments. It is not synonymous with mourning. Confessing, instead, denotes a deep appreciation of the tragedy, a recognition of our current situation and troubles from the perspective of the past. Confessing means interpreting them as a visionary would, using future-oriented concepts and ideas. We have no reason to fear an honest confession. Many who confess did not pass away. The prophets would very often confess, and still they succeeded in transforming the Knesset Yisrael into an eternal nation. Many others passed away without confessing. Many modern Jewish movements have died out and vanished without having confessed and without having considered Jewish problems from the standpoint of min ha'olam v'ad ha'olam, from the eternity of the past to the eternity of the future. In the merit of our confession will we live. See Evel Zutarty, chapter 1. Our healing and salvation depend on confession and introspection. And if, Morai v'Rabotai, confession is a mitzvah incumbent upon all Jews, then surely we, Orthodox Jews, are obligated to confess during such a time of destruction and distress. We must confess twice or even fully three times. You know, of course, that in the past, a single confession on Yom Kippur sufficed for plain Jews. The Kohanim had to confess twice, and the Kohen Gadol three times. Regarding the verses, quote, these are in Numbers 26. When the plague was over, the Almighty said to Moses and to Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, take a census of the whole Israelite community from the age of 20 years up by their ancestral houses, all Israelites able to bear arms. Top of page 8. Chazal, our rabbis, our sages, as cited by Rashi there, say, this is comparable to a shepherd whose flock was attacked by wolves. He counts them to determine how many survived. The Midrash Tanhuma and Parshas Pinchas and the Alkot Shimoni and Parshas Pinchas record the same idea. But in those sources, the text reads how many are missing instead of how many survived. These two textual variants reflect two perspectives, two methods of approaching a terrible, gruesome plague. Number one, the first method seeks to establish how many are missing, to calculate the loss, to portray the misfortune in terms of its horror, rending garments over, quote, the nation of the Almighty who had fallen by the sword. See 2 Samuel 1. Such a count is an act of mourning, grieving, lamenting, despair, and despondency. Such a census echoes with the ancient melody of Elitzion Ve'areha, which is Kina 45, on Tisha B'Av, the dirge of destruction. The second method seeks to investigate how many remain, how many were saved, or can still be saved, so that the shepherd can assemble a new flock. This is not a count of despair or hopelessness, but a census of determination and firm, unshakable resolve, of fiery faith and burning relief, burning belief. Again, unshakable resolve of fiery faith and burning belief. The first count is the cry of, he is a lurking bear to me, a lion in hiding. The second is that of, but you, O God, are enthroned forever. Your throne endures through the ages. Lamentations 5. The second method is that of confession. It's interesting to note that when the Torah ordered that the Jews be tallied, it used the expression se'u, a census of the whole Israelite community. Not sifru, count, but rather se'u. Se'u can denote counting, raising, or carrying, right? Naso is Rosh B'nai Yisrael. Parshas Naso. Se'u she'arim rosheicha. Lift up your gates. Naso, lift up or count. But there's definitely a notion
of the verb lensov, to not just mean count, but also to carry, to be nosei ba'olam chavera, to carry the pain and suffering of your fellow neighbor, your fellow Jewish neighbor, to be a nosei kalim, as somebody who carries the ornaments of war. So there's a notion, he says, se'u can denote counting, raising, or carrying. The word can therefore be translated not only in the sense of taking a census, but also with the meaning of elevating, encouraging, and inspiring. The census commanded by the Torah must be one of firm faith and ecstatic hope, not of despair and despondency. Quote, when the plague was over, that was, of course, back to Numbers 26, when the plague was over, even though the mood was deeply mournful, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, they had to raise their heads. God had said, all Israelites able to bear arms, end quote. Whoever could fight, whoever had courage, whoever could prosecute God's war, count an army of proud, bold, brave Jews, brave Jews who stand with their heads held high. Top of page 9. I think that today I will use the second method, the census of how many survived. And we will count in the sense of se'u, with the ancient halacha of confession, the idea of min ha'olam, the ad ha'olam. To characterize our situation in exile, a few words from Nehemiah will suffice. Hanani, this is from Nehemiah chapter 1, verses 2 and 3. Hanani, one of my brothers, together with some men of Judah, arrived. And I asked them about the Jews, the remnant who had survived the captivity, and about Jerusalem. They replied, the survivors who have survived the captivity there in the province are in dire trouble and disgrace. Jerusalem's wall is full of breaches, and its gates have been destroyed by fire. End quote. These words ring in our ears, not as echoes from over 2,000 years ago, but as the sounds of the living present today, in 1944, as the din emerging from the commotion of the city. We must, however, make one change to Nehemiah's words. Instead of Jerusalem's wall, read the walls of Warsaw, Berlin, Hamburg, Leipzig, Amsterdam, ancient, deeply rooted Jewish communities. The innuendo of the reference to the Jews, the remnants who had survived the captivity, is immensely upsetting. This verse speaks only of the remnant who wallow in the concentration camps, who hide in the forests of Poland, in the marshes of Polesie, and in the steppes of Ukraine. Those who were slaughtered and poisoned are hinted at via the gruesome allusion to the survivors. The verse itself treats only the Jews, the remnants who had survived. But in the entire frightening picture that emerges from Hanani's cryptic report, one element stands in high relief. The gruesome tragedy of our modern times, which is far more terrifying and dreadful than similar tragedies and catastrophes in previous centuries, not only from the quantitative, but also from the qualitative standpoint, highlights one phrase in particular, and disgrace, shame, humiliation, scorn, disdain, and so on. Even our good friends and companions look down upon us with contempt. This is a specific characteristic feature of our modern catastrophe. My friends, we're going to end it over here. This is a very long piece, as I warned you. We've taken a little bite out of it. It is painful, as painful can be, but we've got to look it straight in the eye and listen to it. And how many of us have ever heard any of this? This is incredible. Delivered in 1944. My goodness, that's close on to, what is it now? 80 years ago. 80 years ago, Rabbi Soloveitchik delivered these words. Please come on back, God willing, next week, as we'll continue with our reading of The Parchment is Consumed, but the Letters Fly Free. We'll make every effort to conclude it next week. Please join me then. Until then, Shul Plotzker signing off.
wishing everybody a great day. If there are any questions right now or comments, please join in right now. Feel free to unmute yourself. But if not, we'll wish everybody a good one. Sei gesund. Have a great day. And with God's help, we'll see everybody tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday as we continue our study of 2 Kings chapter 18. Wishing everybody a good day, successful, prosperous, and healthy day. See you tomorrow night at 7:30. All the best. Bye bye now. Thank you, Jake and Mitch from SheerEnjoyment.com. And we thank Goffman Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. Take care and be well. Bye bye now.